This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. 4 years ago, six women at the peak of their careers suddenly shifted. They shifted gears and began studying poetry and writing poetry. And we have an anthology of their new work in my hand. It's called The Song in the Room. These six women are here today, and they're giving you a sample of the work they've been doing, the writing that has developed, and where you can get this in the book, The Song in the Room. So I just want you to hear their voices so we'll identify who they are. So just go around the room and shout out your voice.
Carol Falk.
Natalie Canavor.
Donna Rutero Stern.
Sandy Jackson Cohen.
Janice Booth.
And Meg Robinson.
Now try to remember that. And we're going to give you more than their names right now. These women were former editors, lawyers, journalists, artists, musicians. They became writers of poetry. And we're going to open up with a poem from each, and they're going to tell you whatever inspired them to write this poem, whether it was a form or a prompt. They're going to set it up, and you're going to hear each of them in her own voice. So before you read, give us your name, and then give us the poem. And we'll start with Meg. This is Meg Robinson.
Hi. What I'm going to read is an example of an extended metaphor, and it's called People Are Museums. People are museums. They are collections. They are special exhibits of emotions and ideas and beliefs. People are displays that can be seen at certain times. When the sign says open, when you have a ticket to enter, they sometimes give tours when they want to let you through the door. But when they are closed for visitors, no key will let you in. No passwords or special handshake will let you enter. And in each room, their works can be seen, some of it messy, some neatly framed. The walls are movable. The displays can change. They will sometimes give tours by special request. And when the time comes, the museum will close forever, its contents frozen in time.
What a perfect example of a poem made of metaphors. That was really wonderful. Meg Robinson, I just want everyone to know, is a singer and a songwriter and a composer of music. And she has had her harp compositions played in Carnegie Hall, the Kennedy Center, and right now she's a consultant for a virtual reality group, which is a psychological assistance program. Now we're going to hear from Carol Falk.
Okay. When a poem repeats a word, particularly an end word, it uses a poetic device called an epistrophe. That comes from Greek, meaning a turning back on. So ending my couplets in the following poem with the word snow had a significant meaning for me, particularly on January 20th, which is my title. January 20th, silencing the day, activity stops. Feel the snow. Calming, relaxing, meditating. It moves from outer to inner, the snow. Outside, steps crunch, indenting nature with my presence, the snow. It's a change in scene where nature wears different costumes, a party where the trees are clad in white masks of snow. Cold, crisp air clears breaths, a freezing freshness, the snow. Feeling flakes on my lashes and tasting the cold of them, a gift of nature today, the snow. I also wrote a haiku attached to this poem. Haikus seek to express the extraordinary in seemingly ordinary moments, and is written very simply in the present tense. The popular 5-7-5 rule doesn't exist in America, for it refers to Japanese, not English. Haiku. White flakes consume the scene. Time pauses. Silent. Serene.
If you think that is painterly, It is because Carol Falk is a world-class painter. She started out as a teacher, and she gave that up to become a docent at the Smithsonian. Her field is Asian art. So we're going to go on now with all these different forms, which are fascinating to me. And I bet the listener probably hasn't heard of half of them. So Natalie Canavore, take us away.
Okay. This poem is called A Pantoum, and I had never heard of it myself till recently. And it's a Malaysian form with a series of quatrains, which are four-line stanzas, with a very set pattern of repetition, which I won't try to explain. But it is a little challenging, and I did take some liberties with the form, if you know it. And the poem is called Conundrum. I grumbled because my partner picked a hard route for our first foray into spring. No flat, simple, straight-edged trail with languid water views, but steep ups and downs of rocky, twisted forest terrain. For our first foray into spring, I would have preferred a less adventurous path. Instead, the ups and downs, the rocky, erratic terrain tested my heart, my nerve, my knees. I might have liked as well to take the easy way through life, a flat, simple, straight-edged route, graced with water views. But chance and choice tested my heart, my nerve, my grit. Why, grumble as we may, do we live most vividly when the path is rough?
Natalie, what makes that a pantoum again? Remind us.
Well, the series of four-line stanzas, the second and fourth lines repeat, then the first and third lines of the next repeat, and the last stanza repeats the first and third lines of the first stanza, so it's complicated.
And if you think that's crazy, it is true. But the good thing is, we couldn't even tell. A good form is seamless, and it sounds like it's effortless. You don't hear, oh my, yes, she's repeating that line. So that is made of silk, Natalie. And Natalie herself has edited national magazines. She's run corporate communications departments, taught NYU graduate students, and she is also the author of many books, including Business Writing for Dummies, as well as college textbooks. We're going to get back to you. And we are going to now hear from Janice Booth.
The poem I'm going to read is a villanelle. And a villanelle is a French form of 19 lines. And like the pantoum, it's based on repetition. There are five tercets. And in the tercets, sometimes a word is repeated. Actually, a whole line can be repeated.
What is a tercet?
Oh, I'm sorry. A tercet is a stanza made of three lines.
These women, I mean, they're rocking the world. Go ahead, Jane.
The title of my poem is Conflagration. What is there to fear? Warming glaciers, blistering winds, whispering fire in my ear? Ripe orchards turning sere, fewer apples in the bin, such small things I needn't fear. No salmon in our weirs, fishing eagles grown too thin, screeching fire in my ear. Without clear air to breathe, coughing children, such a din. So much now I've come to fear. Our earth struggles more each year, losing fur and scales and skin, gasping fire in my ear. What use all my tears? I am old. The end is near, whispering fire in my ear. What is there to fear?
Jan, what's a villanelle again?
Villanelle is a French form where repetition enhances the significance of this.
Jan Booth writes a monthly garden column in a very popular magazine. She's been doing this for 5 years. Before that, she had years teaching high school English and college-related subjects. We're going to go on. Donna's here.
Yes, it's Donna Rutterer Stern. Good morning. I'm going to read a poem that was inspired by Louise Glick. Her poem was Unwritten Law, and this is a mentorship from me, from her. I begin again. Fascinating, my story of love. For me, dreamy. Daily, and sometimes continually, as it was being a teen. And invariably, with celebrity men. Shapely, vibrant, or nervously drawing outside the lines, in the mannerism of Picasso. not seeing each as a form of each other. I, with my rigidly stubborn painism, my passionate sights on just one part at once, I fought opposing all new concepts, and still, blundering my teen years, I became sad by virtue of ongoing repetition, being frequently normal. However, with you, I sensed beyond a stereotype, a certain magnificence, softly gliding with respect for the universe, totally conflicting to my being. Respectfully to me, I trusted my future to flourish with you, glorified it wholeheartedly throughout the years. You, with your intelligence and narcissism, eventually uncovering to me the shallowness of my vision.
Donna, you read the poem by Louise Glick, and then you tried to apprentice yourself to her line lengths or her meaning or her images or what?
The line length and meaning. And so I took that as a mentor for this particular poem. And with the theme that I had, based on what her theme was, I developed this poem.
Marvelous way to study poetry.
I agree.
It is marvelous. Donna is an artist, and she is a visual artist with in-brand marketing and advertising, graphic design, large-scale digital murals. I mean, these women are hot.
Thank you.
Sandy Jackson Cohen is with us, and she's going to tell you her poem and exactly how she arrived at this form.
Well, the form is very simple. The prompt for the form was reconnecting with a man at a great distance in time and space, my old high school beau, and to help me think about what I felt about that, I wrote a poem in words of one syllable.
The whole poem, every word is one syllable.
Well, my daughter caught a flaw.
But most of them are.
but yes. The
99%.
Yes. Which was fun. I call the poem More Than Once. What to do? He writes me after years and years, 6 times 10 to be clear. He feels the swell of when we were sweethearts at the start in high school, and then grew a few years. He hoped we would wed, but now he says that when I chose to go, he knew this was right for me to do, for then he could not be the man that I would need. I think he wants me to know how he has grown. He asks more than once to talk, not by phone, but by Zoom from his home on the far side of the globe. Not right away do I write him to say yes. So then on New Year's Day, we see and we speak for 5 quick hours. The call did not seem long at all. At once we were both at ease with much to say, as you may guess. Each face at 40 years has so much changed, some way the same. More than once he looked at me to say, you were my first love, as I looked away. Mm-hmm. He wants to be in touch. It means so much to him if I don't write back, write quick. He frets with cheer, but shows it hurts. How odd, for such long years we shared not a word. To be friends on a sound old base of trust would be okay, would be fine, in fact, to learn of his climb and his work, much praised in the world. But it's come clear he wants to be close, and though this warms me, I do not yield to how he feels. He has not looked yet with his old eyes at mine, as we have come to be here in this time. In him, young thoughts are stirred. He wants to merge our long-gone past into the life he lives at last. I do not wish to hurt him. That's the crux which makes me loathe, too quick to risk his trust. What if I'd learn I'd leave him more than once?
How did we get melody out of monosyllabic words? And I just want to say that poems that tell the secrets of our lives are poems we cannot forget. How hard was that to write?
Not really.
Why? This is, you're telling a secret, you're telling something very private, and you're doing it with a constriction of one word emotions. So why wasn't it hard? Is it because you needed to talk about it?
I was thinking something through that was on my mind. It wasn't a contrived subject. It wanted to be thought through.
But have you ever written two pages in one syllable words before?
Not likely.
Okay. That was Sandy Jackson Cohen. Sandy Cohen enjoyed a diverse career as a government lawyer in the Maryland office of the Attorney General. And she also farmed blueberries in Michigan at one time. So she's got a lot going on. Sandy's now an award-winning portrait painter and runs studios for both figure study and portraiture. These women are multidimensional, multifaceted. We're going to go around the table again and hear from each one of them. We've heard little tastes of different forms, which I think maybe the audience had never heard about. Villanelle, Pantoum, and Carol's wonderful poem, which repeated snow at every line. And that is a different kind of form. So we're going to go back to you, Carol, with another poem and tell us what you've brought us now. And these are all in the book, by the way.
The following is a relationship poem. It's very personal, has to do with my father. It's called Complications. Hanging in a memory for 60 years, the cashmere softness, the rich color, the scent of the fox shawl collar, a very special gift. Back then, I donned its elegance for my father's approval, a princess who loved so unconditionally. Dapper, cultured, with the bearing of a prince, he radiated charm and charisma. But later, his error stained, tainted the memory of the coat. He had strayed, fooling himself while ruining my mother's life. I said nothing, though I knew it was wrong. My mother, forever constant and caring, had been wronged. I felt her pain and knew where my loyalties should lie. Yet I couldn't help but adore my daddy forever, the handsome star who gave me the gorgeous coat and so much more.
You know, that makes me think that you had never really consolidated your thinking about him before that poem.
It's absolutely true.
Boy, that
this was painful.
But what a valuable thing to take your process and make it permanent on the page forever. The portrait of a man who's loved. Mm-hmm. Not a bad thing. Not a bad thing. And we remind you that Carol is our world-class painter. And she's been featured in corporations, her works in hospitals, the FHA, Sallie Mae, other major collectors. Moving on to Donna, who is another visual artist. And Donna is a visual artist who works in big things, big murals, big mediums. And she also is a publisher of children's books. I mean, we got it all going on here. So what's your second poem?
Thank you, Grace. This is a prose, which means it's written without a format. And I got off the elevator of my life on the fourth floor, which was when I was 4 years old. And I remembered a story that was written by my grandfather in words that he just spoke to me. And this poem is part of that. I entitled it Four Lima Beans. Dressed up and excited to see grandfather, he sat happily on a long wooden bench. A brown, circular, wicker basket sat before him on the ground. Above me, a grand arched array of vines intertwined, which went on forever down an uneven dirt path. In a white, cloud-like, fluffy dress with gaping pockets, white lace bobby socks and Mary Janes, pigtails and a bow, I stood before him, gazing up and around. Light glistened in between each leaf and pod, twinkling, shimmering, bright white light. I saw grandfather's foggy silhouette, and hands warm from time and hard work, motioning me to come into the garden, he spoke, and sit down beside me. Together we sat. I listened as grandfather spoke of the wonders of life and the miracle of the garden. He showed me how to pick bean pods hanging from above. The day was warm, the air crisp with a scent of fresh herbs. His love was evident with a grandchild so curious, his words so meaningful. The only time I remember Grandfather, before he lay in white sheets against cloud-like white pillows, I sat on a chair, watching, listening, and remembering picking lima beans on a bright, warm, sunny day. Come into the light, then he went away.
How did you get into that poem? How did you access that poem?
Well, getting off on the fourth floor.
Of where? How did you get on the fourth floor?
Good question. I think it was a bright, white, sunny day, and I thought about lima beans, and that sparked me thinking about my grandfather, and this story came from that thought.
You know, the miracle of poetry is that these are things that are in the air, and they are just not made permanent until the poet just focuses in and dreams her way into the past, and then is able to draw it from the invisible and put it on the page. I consider that a miracle.
I agree.
And have you often thought of that memory?
No. Poetry, amongst all the memories that have been brought, have been because of a poem I've written. So no, I don't think about things. But when I want to write a poem, it takes me back to a time and a moment that I want to create a story with words.
Jan Booth is here reminding you she was our high school teacher and she's a garden expert.
Well, the second poem that I'm going to read is called a regional poem. And for this kind of poem, one chooses a place that we remember, speaking of memories, which Grace is mentioning. And this particular memory was a vivid one for me. This poem is titled The Farm. Three towering firs stand sentry along the road that fronts Grandpa's farm. A ditch 3 feet deep, castle moat indeed, with bridge of boulders and wood, guards entry to the lane at Grandpa's farm. At the end of the lane, past the lofty pines, a great barn looms over Grandpa's farm. But before reaching the barn, wagons, buggies, and cars stop and park beside the porch of Grandma's house. Two sides of the house, wrapped in long ribbons of porches, festoon like bunting on Grandma's house. Screen doors bang, dogs bark, chickens cluck in the barns and beneath the porches of Grandma's house. Visitors enter through the kitchen, past bubbling soup pot and rising bread loaves in Grandma's house. Six pressed back chairs and a red checkered oilcloth embellish the table in Grandma's house. Pot-bellied coal stove, stuffed couch with white doilies, ferns on pedestals, tables with albums and the Bible grace the second and front parlors of Grandma's house. One oak-encased radio, large knobs and arched design, holds pride of place in the second parlor at Grandma's house. And everyone knows to wipe their boots when visiting Grandma's house, 'cause Grandpa will walk you first to see the near fields of corn and wheat on Grandpa's farm. And children's boots will have clods of dirt from chasing chicks into coops on Grandpa's farm. While in the old shed, midst the hay bales and tin buckets, sits the shiny blue Ford on Grandpa's farm. After Sunday dinner, all the siblings and their children gather dishes of leftovers from Grandma's house and load into cars and drive away up the lane and over the bridge from Grandpa's farm.
Remind us again about the scenario that led you to write that poem.
Well, I was asked to write a poem based on a memory of an area or a place. And my grandfather and grandmother were a big part of my early childhood.
And so you sat there and closed your eyes and visualized it?
Mm-hmm. I walked through, yes. I rode down the lane and got out of the back seat of our brown Chevrolet and walked into Grandma's house.
Well, guess what?
What?
We were there. The detail. We were there. Yeah. Jan.
Thank you.
Natalie Canavor has been a businesswoman, and she's an editor, and actually she's won national awards for journalism. So writing poetry is a leap, but then again, she came armed with language. But let's hear that language, Natalie Canavor.
Okay. This poem is called Beach Sonnet. And a sonnet, which most of us have studied at some point, is a traditional form. I learned recently that the word actually means little song. And since the 13th century, it's been very popular, especially among the Elizabethans, among whom, of course, Shakespeare is prime. And I've learned a lot more respect for Shakespeare since trying to write a sonnet of my own. It calls for 14 lines and is a complicated rhyme pattern ending in a couplet, which is two lines that rhyme with each other. So here is my beach sonnet, which came to me because I spent time on the beach last year. What beguiles the eye more than a seashell? Tossed up at our feet by a callous sea, each with its own cryptic story to tell, through pattern, line, and symmetry. We snatch the most flawless from beds of sand to ponder beauty, the meaning of art, hold the perfect small miracles in hand, and feel a joyful upswing of heart. But we decline to consider the sculptor unless we find the alien creature inside. Then we recoil from its slithery horror, our blackest nightmare personified. Is this the inexorable end all along? Throw out the singer, treasure the song.
Amazing. That couplet at the end is a perfect little bow at the end, isn't it? But we don't sit there and say, oh, she's doing that, that line is rhyming with that line, because it is just so effortless, Natalie. But did you sit down to write it, and did you have a line go one, two, one, two, by the lines? How did you write it?
Yeah, when it's a complicated rhyme pattern, I'll write it out, usually A, B, A, B, or A, B, C, D, A, and yeah. And then you have to eventually work with the rhymes and form the line to go with the word that rhymes with the C.
But you,
C,
you like the difficult.
Yeah, I find that the forms channel you into thinking a lot more deeply than you would have in with fooling with language, which is something
you like
I've
to fool
always
with.
Learned. Yes.
Do you think you're going to write poetry for dummies someday?
I'm sure there is a poetry for dummies, but I asked...
How can that be? Because the human spirit cannot be put down that way on the page.
Well, that's a good question, but it's interesting. I asked the editor at one point, what's the most popular dummies book that was ever done? And they said, oh, it was Growing Mushrooms in Your Basement.
Well, then poetry does stand a chance.
There you
Thank
go.
You, Natalie. Meg is next, and Meg is a composer for the harp. Yes, they are still out there. And you compose songs.
Yes, I do. I compose songs and have my whole life.
And you also have a podcast?
I have a podcast.
What's it called?
The Meg Robinson Show.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually write original music for that podcast and do interviews.
And you also are a songwriter with popular songs that are really wonderful and memorable.
Well,
and so let's
you.
Hear this and see if it's a memorable poem.
Okay. Well, as a songwriter, I have been told many times to avoid cliches. That's like the kiss of death. So in this poem, I threw caution to the wind and decided to do nothing but cliches, which was like releasing me from, you know, prison in a way. So here is my poem, The Elephant in the Room. The elephant in the room puts you between a rock and a hard place. You can run, but you cannot hide. Although you're banging your head against a wall, it's the same old story, time and time again. It's hard to live and let live, to let bygones be bygones, to weather the storm, to go with the flow. You want to let sleeping dogs lie. But you can take the bull by the horns. You can call it as you see it. You can leave no stone unturned. You can seize the day. You can open the floodgates and speak your mind. You can set the record straight. There's no time like the present. Never say never. shoot for the moon, bring to a dead end the elephant in the room.
How marvelous. I don't think another piece of literature exists that is made of all cliches. Did you have a thesaurus for cliches?
I had Google, and I gathered as many cliches as I could, and then after that, I figured out, well, what would go with what and what would kind of tell a story, and that's how it all happened. And it was a lot of fun to write.
And it is going to last forever. That is one of my very favorite poems. Meg is a songwriter that you can hear if you Google her name, Meg Robinson. Sandy is our lawyer, and she has had to give up a lot of analytical skills to go into the secret place. What is this secret place? Sandy Cohen.
Well, Grace, maybe I'll read a very brief little piece about engaging with a poem about how it comes to be for me. Shall I do that? Okay. I call it Ars Poetica. Poem, where is your source? How are you shaped? What is your power? You come from within, mystically mining memory and discernment. Emergence not linear, your early form being fluid. As we find our way, as you take your stand, you are saying to me, this is true, this sounds right, let me sing.
While I have you on the griddle, I'm going to ask you a personal question. Now, you've written that poem, and you've read the poem. What's the difference between writing a poem and actually delivering it?
Well, for me, writing a poem is a probing and a discovery process, and delivering a poem is both less and more, I think, because you are personally present in your voice, your inflection, your breath, your whatever, in delivering the poem to someone else. Mm-hmm. But that learning that comes with the writing process, that's not present in the delivery.
But it is essential to give you the confidence to say it. And you don't worry about how it's being received? Do you think about that? Do you care about your listener, your reader?
Sure.
Okay. We're going to actually, I'm going to barrage each one with personal questions now. And since I've got you all, I'm going to ask Meg, what is your process for writing the poem? You get an idea, like you have given yourself prompts, like the cliche, the metaphor, and then do you just sit down and dream into it? Do you scribble? What's your process?
I kind of dream into it because I have to have a clear enough concept to begin to write. And then once I have that concept, I start to write ideas down. Sometimes it'll be a verse. Sometimes it's a group of words that just sort of come together. And sometimes it flows very easily, and other times I have to revisit that same page multiple times to get to the point of getting the flow and all the structure correct.
Why do you do that?
Because I can't. Sometimes I can sit down and write it almost in one sitting, but that's pretty unusual. I'd like to think I could do that every time, but it doesn't work out that way.
Do you hate revising?
No, and as a matter of fact, in this group, I found that the suggestions that I get for revisions always make it better. So I'm very grateful for people giving me that kind of feedback.
Do you think it's tedious going over and over a poem?
No, I don't think it's tedious. I think the hardest part is the first draft of it. I think that's the hardest. And then going back and revisiting is, I enjoy that because I see that it makes it a better poem.
Okay, I'm going to ask a couple more questions. And Natalie, what are you afraid of when you start writing? You look at this white piece of paper and what do you have to overcome?
I think with the poem, it's the same as with writing an article or a script. It's fear of not beginning. And with the poem, as in all the other forms I've worked with over time, it's, as journalists say, finding the lead. And that kind of needs to get to the core of the idea and always answer the question, why care? Why should anyone care?
Oh, fabulous.
And I almost always find with the poetry it works similarly in that once I crystallize my idea or my feeling sufficiently to start exploring it, that I write that first line and the rest follows. And very rarely did it not work for me that way, that I have to throw the whole thing out. But it's so it's struggling away and nibbling away to follow that lead, in effect.
But what I love that you said is about caring about what you're writing. I'm working with someone who does everything right, but there's no, at the end of the poem I say, so what?
So what?
And you don't want that, do you?
No, with any writing, because there are no captive audiences in the world anymore.
There are no captive audiences.
No. People have to choose to listen, to read, to care about what
you're doing. And it's our job, right?
That's the job, you're right. Yeah.
Carol, are you ready for me?
Maybe.
You're an aesthetic person who is looks, cooks, lives as the aesthete of the universe. Why does it matter what it looks like on the page? How do you use space? What do you care what it looks like?
I do.
Why?
I think of it as a design, as a series of patterns, and it has to be balanced, it has to have emphasis, and it has to look pretty.
Why?
So that it'll attract somebody else's eye.
Good answer. Also, I know that you know that I know that you know that a line length is very important because it is your breath control, right?
Absolutely. You have to know where to put the comma or the dash so that you stop for a second. And it can't be too long because you're going to lose them.
See, you're making it sound so easy that everyone listening is going to want to start writing poetry.
Good.
Because it sounds like just a human endeavor. Guess what? It's just human people doing this. Thank you so much. Jan Booth is taking off from her gardening column today. But today we've got you out for a different part of your career. And so we all heard Carol's version of why line lengths matter. What do you say about it?
Well, certainly I support the artist vision of the total page. And I find that when I read poetry, that I need to see it on a piece of paper. Just hearing it only gives me half the experience. But line length has, for me, two purposes. One is that it helps me distill what I'm trying to say, because a line gets to a certain point in my thinking, and then the next line breaks that up. But then when I go back, and as Meg had been saying about revisions going over and over it, I look at the line and I listen to the line so that I can see if my reader will be able to follow how I'm thinking.
I love poets. Mm. I love poets. Just imagine I see you sitting there thinking about your line and caring about whether the reader will be able to get it.
Too. Absolutely.
What a nice way to live. It's a meditative way to live.
It is, absolutely.
And what does it do to you and your state of being when you write?
Oh, it's... I think what it has done has given me another avenue for perspective on life. Because the distillation process that you have to go through to write a poem that has any significance also is a skill or a muscle, at least for me, that the more I use it, the better I am at doing that kind of distillation in life in general.
Are you going to keep doing it?
Absolutely.
Donna is our graphics artist. She's also the publisher of a children's series. What's the title of that book?
Adventures to Awesome.
And you know about Awesome, right?
I do.
Okay.
Poetry is awesome, Grace.
I want to know why it matters to you. Why do you bother? Why do you write poetry? And what do you want from it?
Great questions. So my whole career has been in advertising. We make up words, our sentences are one word, two words. And poetry is a different way to express with words the feelings I have from parts of my life, the past and sometimes the future. And so it helps me to navigate, to come to terms with things in the past and feel great about things coming in the future. And poetry's done this for me, Grace.
They say that art does nothing.
Art does everything.
They say that art makes nothing happen. But you're a living example of the opposite of that, right?
I am.
And what? Why art?
Well, as you know, I consider myself a creative being. Everything I do, see, feel, and hear is about art. Light, color, now words that come together that bring so much emotion. I think just not just for me, but also for the reader of my work.
And so life would not, it sounds like life would be noir without it.
Totally. Totally. Life would be black and white. And there's so much more color to it with poetry.
Love poets. I'm going to get Sandy back here. There are six women here. I want to remind everyone, each one was at the pinnacle of her career. She is and was successful in a particular field and left that to take an exit ramp to do something which took enormous courage, because there is a human attribute, which is a fear of failure. But it appears that these six women looked the other way about that, or they were faced it forward and they said, you know, I'm going to fail better each time, but I'm going to do this. And it's just changed their lives so enormously that I wanted to put them on the air so that everyone could know about transformation. And I consider these six women just thrilling human beings. Let's have a closing poem from each person. And we're going to start with Carol Falk, who is the painter.
My poem is called Touch a Dead Artist. And it arose from a visit to the Los Angeles County Art Museum with my husband. I walked into a room full of Rothkos, and I was bowled over. They're huge, in case you haven't experienced one. 8 by 6 feet. Touch a dead artist. I'm falling into the canvas, a Rothko in orange, red, and white at the museum. A barrier stops me. Built of many washes, each hidden layer a contrasting hue, trapping me in the revealing edges. The yellows sing, the darks gather and retreat. I feel the beat pulsing. If I could touch the ridges, I'd feel his hand and sad and tortured heart.
That's Carol Falk. Meg, give us a closing poem.
Okay, well, in writing an ode, I wanted to write an ode, and I was thinking, what do I want to honor? And then it came to me with this poem as a result called Ode to the Bra.
Tell everybody what an ode is.
An ode is an homage. It's something you're giving recognition to. The idea of honoring the bra came into my head. So here it is. Here it is. Ode to the Bra. You're the queen bee of our wardrobe. You're our favorite, best in show. You have a job that's twice as hard as panties down below. Your two cups fill up gently, made of cotton, sometimes lace. You're our undergarment heroes holding memories in place. You're the one who gives us cleavage. You're the one that we can hook. You're the one who makes us shapely when someone takes a look. Some of you are backless and some are made for sport. Some can make us bigger, but you always give support. When we need to be reminded what a starring role you play, we can try to go without you, but then we start to sway. Your work is never ending, weightlifters, one and all. You hold both gals up nicely, and you never let them fall. In the 50s, you were pointing, then the hippies burned you up. But you never stopped your mission as you held on cup by cup. Once implants were an option, you needed to expand. Double, triple, and quadruple. Bigger chests were in demand. You are clever in construction. Helping babies is a breeze. There are flaps designed for feeding, helping mothers nurse with ease. Sometimes you can be sexy. Sometimes you can reveal all the goodies underneath you that someone might want to feel. We salute you like a soldier. Nipples stand erect and say, thank you for your service each and every single day.
Meg Robinson. And when we see this angelic person behind the harp, we will remember that. And I can just see people riding in their car listening to the radio and pulling off at the nipples to hear the rest of that. Meg Robinson, you never disappoint us. And we're going to go on to Sandy, who's going to give us a final poem.
How to follow that?
Hard.
Oh, my goodness.
Very hard.
Maybe I will go back to a poem that sort of bookends the intensity of the relationship that spurred the poem I read first.
Would you just remind us of that?
Yeah, so this was a reconnection after decades and from long distance with an early love. And it was a gift to both of us, and the friendship that results is still a gift to both of us, but there was a passing of the intensity that blossomed for a while, and I wrote about that.
But you know, having a little bit of knowledge of the backstory, having read your work before, I think it's important to know that these two lovers in college went on to marry different people, have children and grandchildren, and
full lives.
Met again in the blossom of their youth.
Yeah, well, okay. I call this your season. You plowed a deep furrow through my field of equanimity in passing, found what lay fertile in a neglected land, poured your passion into rich, hidden soil, and brought forth a season of amazement while passing. Sprouting fast and fine, reaching high, vining wide, I rose to meet you, coming verdantly alive through your passage. But now, that rarest of seasons has turned. Sap has settled, a splendid joy in you has passed. Dry stalks, laid low by chill winds, soon enough shall have passed. Their scattered cover on a fallow field, after warmth has passed, is but spent remnant of little use, except as testament to marvel at the passage.
I think this lawyer has gone deeper and broader and higher than ever before. Jan Booth, you remember her. She's the teacher.
The poem I'm going to read now sort of picks up on the theme of the farm, the poem I read earlier. This one is in the form of an elevator poem, which was introduced to me as to imagine my life as a multi-story building, and I get on an elevator and I push a button and I get off at a particular floor or age and then proceed to recall some experience at that age.
And what floor did you get off on?
Oh, you'll see. You'll be able to tell. The title is Wild Things. We tucked our skirts up on that summer's day and picked our way along the fallen log, an abbreviated bridge between the order of Grandpa's farm and the wilderness beyond. With all the panache 2 10-year-olds can muster, we sauntered down a well-used trail that swerved and dipped through copses of chestnut, oak, and elm. Our focus? Collecting acorn caps and chestnuts, plump and glowing. But then, from among the trees and underbrush, came charging, necks outstretched and silver wings flapping, Grandma's crazed gander in thunderous cacophony, and his harem 3 of plump gray geese. With danger undeniable, our idol in the forest primal unraveled. 2 silly girls, no match for grouchy geese, scrambled for the barnyard's peace and safety.
You know, the past has never gone very far, has it?
No, not in my life.
And you can get there.
I can, and I enjoy it.
And you do. Jan Booth. Dawn is here. She's our publisher artist.
This particular piece is a recent piece, and I was going through some old photographs and found one of me at 5 years old in front of the home where I grew up in. It's titled, "The Address Doesn't Matter." The cement step was cold, staring out across the little lawn to my neighborhood, all quiet, no children to play with again. Even then at five, I felt a gray darkness looming. I remember such sadness, wanting to cry, but I didn't. I didn't know how. It pains me right now to bring back those memories. I remember such emptiness, loneliness, the only child on the street without siblings. Five Irish kids next door on the left, four Irish-Italian on the right, two Italians catty-corner across the street, two Russians across from my home, and the big Greek family two doors down. And then there was the sibling-deprived Lithuanian girl. My mom celebrated a fifth birthday party for me. All the kids in the surrounding homes came. Feelings of fun and being wanted, feeling of wonderment. So many neighborhood kids from different heritages. I grew close with one friend, Boris, my Russian neighbor. He was 1 year older and in a grade above me. For some reason, I was attracted to his uniqueness. I don't think any of the other kids were. He was continually bullied for his name and heritage. I remember his right arm broken in a full arm cast all summer, most likely his aggressors. He committed suicide by the time he was a teen. Devastating to me. I was alone, all alone. To this day, I am still alone. No siblings, and most family passed. And my sons have gravitated to their wives' families. Heightened sadness is recognized. Opening the box of childhood memories has been a difficult one. Again, an onset of adult emotions, I'd much rather have preferred to put it up on the shelf and push it way back behind the box of old photos. Sitting within my cozy outdoor porch, rocking as I admire the grounds before me, no one outside or even around to converse with. Times don't change as we age, it's just a different address, and the cold cement still sends me shivers.
You got this from looking at a photo?
I did.
And that is a good way to write a poem, right?
It sure is.
So
it
we can call
up
that
so many emotions.
Ekphrastic poetry.
There we go.
Yeah.
Ekphrastic,
so,
yes.
Do you think you might use that way again to prompt a poem?
I think I would. It brings up a lot of emotions, things that I've just kind of pushed way, way down. And I think it's really good to bring that back up and recognize where you've come from and where you are and where you're going to go.
But you know what I like about that is your honesty in telling us exactly how you feel.
Yeah.
Because you can't turn away from that.
You cannot.
You can turn away from form, you can turn away from language, but you cannot turn away from authentic feelings. So thank you.
You're welcome. Again, this is what poetry has done for me. So thank you, Grace.
Well, you're giving us a lot today, and we're going to end with Natalie. Oh. Natalie is going to rewrite Poetry for Geniuses. That's your next book.
For Geniuses. I'll interview everyone here. That's right. Okay, this, unlike what I read previously, this poem has no form. I don't know if they still use the phrase free verse, but maybe that's what it is, or is that out of date? No. And it's called Maybe. Where do memories go when our meter runs out? And what are memories? A mental reservoir of film clips set on random replay, or maybe morsels of frozen time that just melt away. Or maybe it's a mirage to think memories are uniquely our own. Maybe we borrow them from some vast collection, a library of memories common to all humans or all mammals. And when our time is up, we must give them back, like books we borrow.
Hmm.
I'm happy enough to return the minefield of memories that make me miserable at 4 a.m. All those sins of mission and omission, mishaps, misunderstandings. But how to maintain as my own the miracle moments? Baby's first smile, the smell of a lilac, the magic of romance, the mystery of a Beethoven quartet, the taste of fresh bread. Now the meter ticks louder. I've already returned a host of memories, along with many of the words I spent a lifetime mastering. I imagine them rematerializing in someone else in their time. Yet I feel driven to marshal and maintain some of the memories that remain to me, and maybe I still have time to make or take some new ones for myself.
That was Natalie Canavor. And I just want to remind you again that we've been listening to six women who have been meeting for 4 years, almost 3.5 years actually, and they meet every 2 weeks without fail. They study poetry, they write new poetry. It is amazing. There's an anthology of their work, which you can get on Amazon. It's called The Song in the Room. These women will never be the same again, and we won't either because of their writing. I believe that they've taught us a lot about transformation. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, and by the Maryland State Arts Council. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.